first case is 95-1522, Janet Phillips versus James C. Burke, M.D. at St. Elizabeth Medical Center. Mr. Green.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm Casey Green and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, St. Elizabeth Medical Center. I'm also joined by my colleague Stan Evans, who is here to argue on behalf of AMICUS, the Ohio Hospital Association, and the Ohio State Medical Association. And I've allotted 5 minutes of my time to Mr. Evans. I would also like to reserve a minute for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Thank you.
I made a valiant attempt to try to distinguish this case from Browning versus Burke. Isn't it just the same?
No, Your Honor. No, I don't think you need to overrule Browning.
You'd like that,
Well, in the perfect world, yes, Your Honor, I would like it overruled, but alternatively, and actually the central theme of my argument today is, with apologies to Johnny Cochran, if it doesn't fit, you must remit. This case, unlike Browning, involves a full trial record. It shows the full extent of plaintiff's allegations in this litigation, and it shows that Browning just does not, the test set forth in Browning just does not fit here. Accordingly, my primary argument is the court needs to modify Browning to suit the particular facts of this litigation. The facts shown in the trial record here demonstrate that Browning doesn't fit. This complaint was filed in April of 1986. That's 2.5 years before the television show that this court identified in Browning as an alerting event. So this lady discovered her claim, went to court, and 2.5 years later, the alerting event occurred. Or in the trial record here, actually, her counsel, I think, tried to established that her claim actually arose in the middle of trial. They elicited testimony from her at trial saying, Ms. Phillips, when did you learn about peer review? And she said, well, actually in the middle of this trial. So this case shows that applying Browning, the plaintiffs could even make the argument that their case arose 5 years after it was filed and 3 or 4 weeks into a 7-week trial. It only makes sense, obviously, that an alerting event must precede the filing of the lawsuit. I think it's significant that plaintiffs have nowhere in their briefs cited an alerting event that preceded the filing of this lawsuit. Similarly, the Court of Appeals cited no alerting event that preceded the filing of this lawsuit. And as I pointed out, the alerting event test in this situation allows plaintiffs to try and make the argument that their case arises in the middle of their trial.
Well, if we adopted your proposition, would we not be in the position of having to decide every one of the 60 or 70 women's cases that this doctor mutilated being different occurrences or accruals of their action? How would that be something? Would we have to study the law for an entire state and for entire populace? That's our job. Now, you want us to decide every one of these cases on an individual basis?
No, Your Honor. I think what we have here is there are two different types of negligent credentialing claims. Al Bain identifies the two different types. And what I'm suggesting is there ought to be two different discovery rules depending on whether you're talking about an incompetent physician or an incompetent surgery. In this case, I invite the court to check the record. There is no evidence that Dr. Burt was an incompetent surgeon or that he was an incompetent gynecologist. The argument is that he did an incompetent surgery. In that instance, how can the hospital discover that Dr. Burt is incompetent when there is no evidence that he's incompetent?
Wait, did you say he's not an incompetent surgeon, he just does incompetent surgery? And the hospital knew that. They even had him sign a form saying that this is not recognized.
I think part of the problem is another thing that's significant here, the record in this case will show to the court that there are some misconceptions about these cases. First of all, there are 18 cases currently pending. The remaining cases have been resolved. But this record shows that there are some misconceptions about these cases that are evident in Browning and I think maybe in the Drescher case as well. The first is that all Dr. Burt did was mutilate women. This is just not true. This record shows that there are people that successfully had this procedure. And in fact, the record shows that there were, for a limited period of time before 1981, there were at least 3,500 admits by Dr. Burt and one patient who complained. There's also Plaintiff's Exhibit 80 is a published paper regarding the surgery that was published in the medical literature, which shows that 89 of 91 patients who had the procedure had it successfully and none had permanent complications. We also identified, did not call because there was a stipulation, but we identified a number of patients who have successfully had the procedure.
But isn't that you said that the doctor was not incompetent, but wasn't what he was doing a false or fraudulent, fictitious medical treatment? Isn't that the essence of the claim?
That is the essence of the plaintiff's claim. I'm not here to concede that it was a false, fraudulent procedure because, as I say, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it might have had some merit.
Yes, but
the hospital can't.
But it wasn't something that was accepted by the medical community, and the hospital was aware of this.
Well, it wasn't something, I think it was a situation where the hospital or the whole medical community did not know whether it was good or bad. They didn't have evidence that people were being harmed by it. And in fact, as I say, there's a great amount of evidence that women had this procedure successfully. A hospital can't practice medicine.
Okay, well, some time has expired since Dr. Burt first engaged in the surgery. Is there a body of medical literature now that supports the so-called love surgery as a good thing?
There are at least two physicians I know of that have also done the procedure and have done it successfully.
Hasn't it generally been repudiated by the literature and the medical establishment as such?
I don't think there's any literature either way. No one has published against this either. There are experts for plaintiffs who have tested.
The medical board allowed Dr. Burt to retain his license to practice medicine?
He has not retained his license to practice medicine. He turned in his license and he retired some time ago. I'm not advocating the surgery. All I'm saying is that, particularly at the time period we're talking about, there was enough substance or apparent substance to this procedure that the hospital had no business getting involved.
It generated a lot of revenue for the hospital, didn't it?
Well, actually, I don't think there's any evidence in the record to that effect.
3,500 procedures?
No, 3,500 patient admissions. Now,
In what kind of a time frame?
Over the period of the evidence in the record is from the years 1971 to 74 and 77 through 81, I believe.
That's a pretty healthy practice.
It was a very healthy practice. And another point there is, those are admits to St. E's. Another thing that I think has been a misconception in Browning and in the media attention to this case is that Dr. Burt had privileges at all the Dayton hospitals. This surgery was done at all the Dayton hospitals.
Is it in the record whether or not this patient was given the special admission form to sign that was unique to Dr. Burt?
Yes, this patient, and that is part of my argument that because we have, the situation here is that we've got a surgery that's claimed to be incompetent. We could bring in the best gynecologic surgeon in the entire world. If he did this surgery, the plaintiff would still sue and claim that we had allowed a false, fraudulent, fictitious medical procedure. And that's why I suggest that for this type of negligent credentialing claim, the discovery rule has to be directed towards the procedure.
Issue we're talking about today is a real legal issue of about the statute of limitations of when a case needs to be brought. And that's, I'm interested in that, your issue about the negligent credentialing and when it should arise and what, when should the, is there, assuming that the Browning versus Burt case and the alerting event hold forth, now what is, what should be the alerting event here in a negligent credentialing claim?
In this kind of negligent credentialing claim, when the procedure is at issue, and in fact plaintiffs have argued it should be discovery of the conduct, well, the conduct here that they're claiming was negligent was the allowing of this procedure. I believe that the discovery test for this type of negligent credentialing claim should be that the cause of action arises when the patient knows or should know that she may have been injured as a result of a false, fraudulent, or fictitious procedure. And that's where the consent form, the Mr. Justice Pfeiffer mentioned, comes into play. It may not be significant to learn to alert somebody that it's, that he's, that a physician is incompetent, but it is certainly enough to put somebody on notice that this might be a questionable procedure. The hospital is saying, we don't know if this is good or bad. You make the decision whether to have the procedure.
If
you said you didn't advise having this done, or was that effect, right? You said you're not advocating this procedure.
In light of all that has happened in
earlier
no.
in your argument, you said that.
I'm not advocating it at this point in light of all the.
Why don't you advocate this procedure?
Well, I think that probably gets into personal views. That don't really play on the.
Do you feel that the procedure is wrong?
No, actually, in 7 years worth of doing this litigation, I have met with enough happy patients to. I really don't know the answer to the question of whether
so
this is a good or bad procedure.
You're saying you wouldn't advise anyone having this procedure, but if someone wants to have it, they should be allowed to have it.
That's exactly right. This is America, and if somebody wants to have a procedure, in my view, I don't think people need nose jobs either.
All these people you've talked to that are really happy with this procedure, did they know what they were getting into?
I believe so. In fact, most of them
were properly informed.
Yes, Your Honor. They all make it clear that this physician actually went into ad nauseum into what he was going to do surgically.
But in this case, he certainly didn't.
Well, actually, if you look at the medical records, which I believe are Plaintiff's Exhibit 13, it indicates that there was extensive discussion and informed consent. And in fact, that's another thing that this record shows that differentiates it from Browning, is that this lady knew what she was getting. There are four or five witnesses who testified that she knew about this procedure in advance. The medical records also lay out, none of this was before the court in Browning, but the medical records lay out extensive discussion with Ms. Phillips beforehand. And so this case is not one where this lady was an unsuspecting patient.
So the procedure is so wonderful, why hasn't the doctor been able to get his license back?
I don't believe he's tried to get his license back. He had health problems and moved to Florida. And he's now, I think, mid to late 70s. I wouldn't foresee someone at his stage getting back into the practice of medicine anyways. He has, and the media here has covered this, he has talked about developing a foundation where his work can be continued. So he is, in fact, he has moved back to Dayton.
Legal issue in this case. Are you trying to get the statute of limitations for negligent credentialing to be the same as for medical malpractice?
That would be one alternative that the court could look at, but again, no, I don't think so.
Is that what your first proposition of law says?
No, Your Honor, it is not. The first proposition of law suggests that for this type of negligent credentialing claim, the discovery rule should be when the patient knows or should know that she's been injured as a result of a false, fictitious procedure.
So you're satisfied with the 2-year statute of limitations for negligent credentialing?
I accept the 2-year statute of limitations for that, yes, Your Honor.
I know that your association, Mr. Evans' association, has been actively involved in the tort reform bill. I had a legislative summary over to my office that I read the other day, and now it's reduced to 1 year, so it doesn't
It doesn't, that provision I do not believe applies to this, to these cases.
Now, the legal issue then is when did the alerting event occur? If you're willing to accept what Browning versus Burt says, how do you want to modify Browning versus Burt?
I want to modify Browning versus Burt to focus on the procedure. I think that the Court of Appeals focused on the incompetent, the discovery rule needs to focus on the surgery. It needs to focus on when did this patient learn that she may have been injured as a result of a bad surgery, as opposed to.
Those are different because the date of the surgery is the word occur. That's when this was injury, damage, malpractice. It occurred. The issue before us should be when did it accrue. Now, what alerting event do you have that says this accrued at a period of time that you did not bring your cause of action?
There, much of it is laid out in our brief. There is one, there was one item of proof that isn't cited in the brief that I do want to call to the court's attention. It's at supplement page 53, an affidavit from Phillips where she said she was told that by Dr. Burt that he did surgery different than all other gynecologic surgeons. The special consent form alerted her that she was getting a procedure that was questionable.
And also told her not to check with anybody else because there would be problems if she did.
No, the form didn't.
No. What the deposition? I read her deposition.
Yeah, well, that she claims that Dr. Burt told her not to see another physician, which I think is just further evidence that should have caused her to question Dr. Burt, because what competent physician would advise someone who's 35 years old? You can't see another doctor. This is a woman who presumably might live for 40 years and need gynecologic exams for 40 years.
One who might be engaging in fraud. Now, that may come as a real surprise to you, but we've even had cases where the doctors have changed the records, altered the records to blame it on the patient.
We have no evidence of that here.
Well, his statements to her, those statements to her wouldn't go to the hospital, would they?
No, Your Honor. That's part of the problem here.
He was telling her, you know, don't you go to some other doctor or you're going to be in trouble. They didn't know that.
That's exactly right.
There's no evidence of that, I guess.
There is no evidence that the hospital knew he was making these statements.
Wrong, there's no question, but the issue is whether the hospital was wrong and what the statute, what period of time that she had. Didn't her visit to Dr. Clark, isn't that another point at which she should have been, the Clark that she should have been on notice?
Well, I think she was on notice well before the visit to Dr. Clark. The visit to Dr. Clark just shows additional evidence that she would have gathered had she not waited for nearly 2 years to go see a physician after she stopped with Dr. Burt. For the reasons stated in our brief and in the argument today, we would ask the court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and enter judgment for St. E's. Thank you very much.
In a minute, sir, we'll see, but in a minute, with all respect, I don't think that.
Okay, all right. Mr. Lanciano.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices, good morning, and may it please this honorable court. I think something that has been ignored here about this case is that a jury heard the evidence, and a jury decided in answers to interrogatories that St. Elizabeth was negligent in their credentialing practices.
Isn't the issue whether or not the legal issue that comes up way before it gets to a jury is whether or not the plaintiff has filed her case sufficiently timely? So the jury decision is something secondary to whether or not the case was timely filed.
Yes, Justice Cook, I was going to get to that, because the reason that did not become part of the case, and because judgment for $5 million was not rendered against the hospital, is because the court instructed the jury improperly on the statute of limitations. Now, the question here is the discovery. the discovery doctrine is designed to allow injured persons sufficient time after they are aware of or should be aware of that some negligent conduct caused them injury. Now, this focus on the injury itself has been debated time and time again. And to say that when someone appreciates that they have an injury after surgery or after hospitalization, which many, many people do, because every surgery doesn't make the patient well and running out of the hospital feeling perfectly safe and sound, so that an injury in and of itself may be a complication that is an acceptable risk of the surgery. But when they do discover an injury, then there has to be some nexus between the injury and some misconduct of someone, not necessarily the physician who did the surgery, but there may be others who have contributed to that.
And Mr. Lanthier, isn't that, I mean, it seems to me you're arguing for a real departure from Ohio tort law, in that we have historically, we look to the discovery of the injury. That's all a person knows. They know that, and it seems to me you are advocating that the statute of limitations should run from when the plaintiff knows the legal significance of their injury.
Well, the phrase legal significance is not one that I would choose to use. I would choose to use when they know.
What plaintiff knows that their hospital might, they use us, lawyers, for that, don't they, to find out who all might be responsible for. I have a terrible problem with my physique right now.
The patient is held to exercise reasonable care to know and understand what's going on. And in this case, this particular case, when her physician, Dr. Burke, told her, don't go to another doctor because you may die, she didn't go to another doctor. She went to Dr. Clark, and Dr. Clark looked at her and he said, I have never seen any such surgery like this. I don't know how it could have been done. I don't know why it could have been done. You better go see a lawyer. And so that should alert her to the fact that this surgery was totally unacceptable, totally unknown to a gynecologist that she went to. And the hospital said this. The hospital said to this patient when she was going to get the surgery, the female coital area reconstruction surgery you are about to undergo is, one, not documented by ordinary standards of scientific reporting and publication, two, not generally accepted procedure, three, as yet not duplicated by other investigators, four, detailed only in non-scientific literature. Now, she's told, we'll allow the surgery to be done in our hospital, but we're not saying anything about it that it's safe or unsafe. They have a basis somehow to know that what kind of surgery he was doing and what kind of problems were arising. There's never been a patient to testify that they were happy with this surgery. Never one.
Since we're talking about statute of limitations, is that letter a double-edged sword? I mean, you're arguing that it really shows some liability on the part of the hospital.
That's right.
That seems a valid point.
Right.
But doesn't it also suggest that, and we have to use an objective standard here about Ms. Phillips or any other plaintiff, we have to use an objective standard, which is knew or should have known. So should she have known, and how should we treat this business about a doctor telling you not to go? Does that mean the should have known? I mean, shouldn't a person have known? Is that objective?
Should she have known from that? Should she have known that the hospital consciously disregarded the safety of a patient and allowed a doctor to perform a false, fraudulent, and fictitious surgery? I don't think so. She kept going back to the doctor. She must not have thought he was that horrible. She went back until it finally got so bad, and she got so frightened because he said, don't go anywhere else because you may bleed to death, you may hemorrhage, that she finally went to another doctor. She was inquiring. And when she went to that doctor, she filed a lawsuit within 1 year of the time of going to that doctor and having that doctor say, I've never seen anything so horrible in my life, you'd better go to a lawyer. I think that's the alerting event. That tells her this man is doing something so outrageous that you better look to the hospital to see why he continued to be allowed to do this surgery for all these years. And I think that's what the Browning test says. That is the law of Ohio.
You think that alerted her to look to the hospital?
Absolutely.
Instead of to her physician?
What, she was already...
It's different than any other malpractice case, huh?
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. There's the malpractice against the physician, and there is the separate corporate negligence of the hospital. The hospital is run by a board of directors. Most of the time, they're not a board of trustees or board of directors. There's no doctors on it, usually. That's what we're looking towards.
Going back to the first jury found that there was, in fact, a statute of limitations issue against the doctor and hospital on malpractice, correct?
Absolutely. They were charged incorrectly under the law.
Well, not against the doctor, only against the hospital.
Against the hospital.
But they looked at the facts and decided that the doctor, that she didn't file within the statute against the doctor, correct? Even though they did find on the fraud issue, but not on the malpractice issue.
Against the doctor.
Against the doctor. If we do not modify Browning at all, and we find that Browning equally applies to negligent credentialing or the fraudulent procedure issue, whether you argue they're one of the same or not, you could conceivably go back to trial and still lose again on statute of limitations because the jury may buy the argument that informed consent was an alerting event. Could you?
Well, it is a question of fact. It becomes a question of fact, so they could decide if a patient was reasonable or unreasonable in appreciating or being have a presumption grafted upon them so that they would have knowledge. But
so even if we were to affirm the Court of Appeals and grant you the new trial, you could still go back and you could still lose.
I think that's true, but there's no reason to modify Browning, which fits every single case that exists in this particular framework of Dr. Burt's cases.
So it really becomes a jury issue as to what the alerting event is.
It may become a matter of law also, as it was in Browning.
Well, the hospital has given a whole list of things that they think should have alerted her. You have given reasons why you don't think they should be things that alert her. That's really a jury issue.
Well, they have said that there is nothing in the briefs about the alerting event. The alerting event, presumed by everyone in this case, was Dr. Clark. I mean, that was in the evidence, and
But that was an alerting event for lawyers, not for her, because she testified in trial that she didn't know about peer review until she got to trial. So really,
it was from her, because her doctor told her to go to a lawyer. The lawyer didn't come and find her and say, "Hey, I heard you have a case that, you know, I'd like to look into St. Elizabeth's Hospital's liability." She was sent because a doctor told her, gave her such facts that sent her to a lawyer.
Right, and the lawyer is the one that figured out that she had a negligent credentialing claim, not the patient.
Well, a lawyer is going to discover through an investigation, which is what the whole purpose of the discovery doctrine is to tell a patient that's injured, patient, you must exercise diligence in following all of your possible causes of action. That's what it says. And how do they do that? Well, they either investigate it on their own or they go to a lawyer. But the person is supposed to, there has to be some kind of alerting event to make them act. And in this case, the act that finally got to this patient was Dr. Clark telling her what he told her, I believe.
She still didn't understand the legal significance of it till the trial.
Well, I'd say probably most people don't, but I think that it's not a question of legal significance. It's a question of the patient being alerted to such facts that caused them to take some kind of action.
Isn't that what cognizable event is all about?
Yes, this is grafted. The cognizable event was the tree from which they grafted the alerting event for the negligence in credentialing in Browning. I think that's what it was. I think so.
Okay. The second question is, they're making an additional claim now in this case about peer review. Could you address yourself to that and the importance of the peer review issue?
The issue that they're making in this case on peer review is, I believe, the immunity issue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't think that the statute intended to relieve any party from responsibility for injuries suffered by a patient. I believe the purpose of this statute was to prevent doctors from suing each other because one doctor testifies in a committee about another doctor or things that are done in the, within the peer review arena. I think that is protected under the statute. I don't think that doctors can sue for simple negligence, can sue each other. I don't think there was ever any intention, and the statute has an exclusion. It says nothing in this section shall relieve any individual or hospital from liability arising from the treatment of a patient. Now, I think that that was intended to say that nobody is given blanket immunity from negligence that causes injuries to a patient. I don't think that it harms, that interpreting it that way harms peer review at all.
And in part, we decided that in Moskowitz.
Yes, and of course, it was decided in Browning.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any reason to change that, and I don't think that anyone would expect that a whole, that a blanket immunity was given to everyone that had anything to do with peer review for injuries to a patient.
Let's assume that the procedure here was a procedure involving a heart bypass, and it was a procedure that had been used but not with which there hadn't been a lot of success. And the hospital gives the patient the same waiver and essentially says this is experimental, results may be good, they may not be good, but we're going to let this procedure occur in our hospital. And the doctor becomes, in the third surgery, is more invasive than the patient thought the doctor would be. How do we, I guess what I'm concerned about in this case is how do we permit hospitals to permit surgeries that may not yet be proven, but with patients having been advised of the fact that not a proven surgery, not something that's common, and there may be risks. How do we assure with the rule in Browning that a hospital can do that, or should we not be concerned about that?
Well, I think you can be concerned in the sense that it can give rise to a discussion, but I think in most surgeries that begin with an experimental stage, and heart surgery is one of those which we've seen developments occur and procedures in non-invasive procedures, so-called, that involve putting stents into the arteries and expanding those stents, and there's been a lot of controversy about that. But the leading cardiac surgery centers in the country develop these and talk about them and write about them, and even though they may be considered experimental to a certain extent, they are recognized by their peers, at the Cleveland Clinic and in Houston and in Minneapolis, where the heart centers and all the surgeries going on. These doctors all know one another and talk about the surgery and decide that it's worth the risk. They balance the risk against the weight of the success of the surgery, and say that even though this may be experimental in a sense, it's not purified, it's not done everywhere, we only do it in the specialized hospitals. That happens all the time in surgery, and I think in those cases, if someone would criticize that and say this was not recognized, the peers, the surgeons would come and back up. The surgeons from other centers around the country would back up. This
well,
is
what
not
you,
like
what
went
you,
on here. This was just not accepted. There was nobody that came in and said that this surgery was an acceptable surgery.
But would the waiver in that situation be an alerting event or a cognizable event? Would the waiver, the fact that the patient signed, understood, signed the waiver, would that be an alerting
I don't think it would be. All it would be is giving the patient informed consent. If the patient were then find out that this was a fraud, that the hospital did not have the sufficient basis and the doctor did not have sufficient background and his surgery was not accepted by his peers as being useful, I don't know how the patient could know that, because the hospital's saying, we will permit this surgery to be done. It's non-standard. It's not recognized. It's not backed up in the literature. If it's a fraud, if it's a fictitious surgery, how can the patient know? The patient is unsophisticated.
But the patient doesn't need to know the legal impact, as you know. So the fact that the patient has been advised before the surgery, this is not typical, there are these sorts of things that may occur, and the patient winds up with a different result, totally different result than they expected, that doesn't alert the patient that something may have happened here that shouldn't happen?
Well, maybe for the surgeon, if it went far enough, if the results were far enough from what was expected, it may, you know, under the circumstances, it may alert that the surgeon perhaps did something wrong. But how does it transfer and develop into a nexus between the corporate negligence in failure to prevent this from happening and failure to save the patient from the false and fictitious surgery? I don't see that happens when you tell a patient this is experimental. You don't say you're likely to get harmed by this. Now, if they want to go that far and say you're likely to be harmed, then of course they probably wouldn't get anybody to consent to the surgery.
You've used your time.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Green, you've used your time. Can we take 30 seconds?
Counselor,
very quickly, yes.
Maybe you can help me make some sense out of this. This case, if you have to go to trial on it, is a case based on what against your hospital?
It's based on plaintiff's claim is that we negligently allowed this surgery to be performed on her,
okay,
that we failed to review the surgery.
Credentialing. That's the cause of action.
The cause of action is negligent credentialing,
okay,
for allowing allegedly false fraudulent procedure.
And if I understand your position correctly, the letter signed on 10/22/81 by this patient is the alerting event. Is that correct?
Actually, in part, yes. I think that alone is sufficient.
So you're saying this letter is an acknowledgement that your hospital was engaged in negligent credentialing. I mean, that's what you have to be saying. This letter is saying to this patient, we have engaged in negligent credentialing, and you should be aware of that.
No, I don't think that a test that requires you to essentially admit you're negligent is going to work in any area of the law. I think what this is saying is that the surgery you're about to have, we don't know about.
Okay.
It's
really a waiver, isn't it? I mean, you're attempting to get them to waive off any suit.
Well,
isn't that what that letter is?
No, I think what that letter was a notification. And by the way, that letter actually came from the Montgomery County Medical Society. Everybody in the medical community, they're basically saying, we don't know if this is good or bad. We don't have evidence that it's bad. You decide whether you want to have the procedure. Which, actually, the question about the consent form, I guess
I find it curious that a letter that you sign before you go in to have surgery would be deemed to be the alerting. I mean, this is before you're put under, before you roll in the room. You're deemed to be put on notice that malpractice is about to occur.
I'm glad you raised that issue, because it's not actually accurate that is the alerting event, because you have to have the harm afterwards. But you have to have the, I think Chief Justice Moyer analyzed that in his dissent in Browning, that you've got to have, you've not only got to discover the credentialing issue, but you've also got to have the injury, because without the injury, you don't have a claim.
If her surgery had been performed exactly as she had hoped it would be performed, and she got the results she wanted to get, the letter wouldn't be any alerting event, would it?
There would be no suit.
Combine the letter with her results, she got cut much more than she thought she was gonna get cut, and she was painful, and all these things, it's a combination, isn't it?
It's the combination that does it.
So then the surgery is the alerting event?
You need both, you need to have the injury before, or there's no lawsuit, but you have to have the indication that you may have had that you've had a questionable procedure to couple the two together to have the alerting event, or whatever you would wanna call the test. The consent form is really important to touch on, for the first time I finally heard what the plaintiff's position is as to what the alerting event was here, and they say it was this physician saying, I've never seen something like this before. We have in the record here, and this gets to issue number three, which argues that we can keep Mr. Justice Douglas's alerting event test and we still should prevail in this case. Based on their admission that that's the alerting event, we've got that in the record here way before the suit was filed. As I indicated at supplement page 53, we've got a signed affidavit from Ms. Phillips herself saying, Dr. Burt told me he does surgery different than every other gynecological surgeon in the world. And then she gets this form that says, you're about to have something that's unproven, non-standard. That is a whole lot more than a doctor examining her and saying...
So Justice Stratton is correct that if you lose here today, you're still back to a jury on a jury question as to when did the alerting event
occur? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think the evidence is so strong, whether you keep the alerting event test and properly interpret it, or whether you modify it as we are suggesting, either way, I think as a matter of law, the hospital is entitled to judgment. However, alternatively, obviously, the issue, at minimum, it's an issue of fact for a jury. Thank you very much.